So we are on the track of the meaning of Sri Aurobindo's poetry. I think we need to acknowledge that there is something that we might identify as the mind of Sri Aurobindo. And so his poetry is an expression of something quite particular and unique, both in its form and its content. We've mentioned this a few times. For example, in the poem about the silent witness, we read two or three poems about that perspective or that experience, which he's keen to have us understand. He's written many poems about it. And there are many passages in Savitri about that point of view, that experience. So what we find as we read Savitri again and again is that there are a few major themes, experiences, movements of consciousness that he dwells upon. There aren't many. There are a few. So last time we looked at one canto, in book 7, that dwells upon three forces of the soul of Savitri. One of them we read, Madonna of Love and Pity. And in that canto there are two others. There is Madonna of Power, and there is Madonna of Knowledge. Madonna of Power has different dimensions: creation and destruction and work, from the vast to the narrow. But in that canto, she is the goddess of work, human achievement. And then Madonna of Knowledge is also Madonna of joy and peace and light and the life of the mind. And so if we step back from that trilogy in that canto, we see the three principles of the integral yoga: love and devotion, bhakti yoga, work and sacrifice, and the power of tapasya, and knowledge. And in that book, Savitri has a dialogue with each of these soul powers and visualizes a transformation of each of them. A little bit further along in that book, Savitri enters into the inner countries, and on her journey to find the soul, she explores the plane of matter, the plane of life, and the plane of mind in consecutive sections of that book. Before she finds the soul, and so we can see in the structure of Savitri, also in the Traveler of the Worlds, there's a major section in which the Traveler of the Worlds explores physical creation, and the Traveler of the Worlds explores the vital creation, and then he explores the mental creation. And that's the longest book. It's 13 cantos that are exploring these planes. So this is one of the predominant themes and structural elements of Savitri. And we know that Sri Aurobindo speaks about the universe and creation and life in terms of planes of existence. So for him, the physical plane, the vital plane, and the mental plane encompass the threefold world of manifestation. And he wants us to learn to interpret life, existence, in terms of universal forces. He wants to teach the mind to shift from the sensory world and the idea world to the intuitive or higher mind world view that sees and interprets everything in terms of universal principles. This has a depersonalizing or impersonalizing effect psychologically. If we can do that, then our experience of the world is not fragmented and judgmental. It encompasses our physical multifarious existence and our vital and mental existence, not as individuals, but as parts of a totality that includes all individuals. And everything that we see and everything that we know and everything that we do in the world is in a field, is done in a field and seen in a field of physical, vital, and mental forces. So one of the purposes of Savitri, a didactic purpose, is to guide us towards that way of perceiving. another structure that we find, and another theme that we find repeatedly in Savitri, is the theme of sacrifice. Of searching for the soul, and we covered this last time, the journey theme, the epic of the search for the soul and the epic of the transformation to the highest regions, towards the highest regions of consciousness. This journey is there throughout. But then there is added to the journey a heroic element. It is done for a purpose. The sacrifice, the search, is done for the sake of an end. And that end is no less than the salvation of humanity. The salvation of the suffering world. The transformation of the world of ignorance and suffering into a world of truth and light. So this journey is taken not for the sake of the individual soul's liberation. It's taken for the sake of a liberation and transformation of the whole. So tonight I'm going to sort of run through a few examples of that very specific, very definite, recurring theme. And the third theme that I want to examine, if we can get to it, is the process. What this search entails. How is it accomplished? What is the inner movement of sacrifice, really? How do we do it? How does Asvapati do it? How does Savitri do it? How is it to be done? And that takes us into the discovery of the soul and the opening to the higher planes through the absolute stillness of the being. This is the method. So we will explore that in a number of passages so that we're clear about these intentions, these movements, these ways of understanding that are Sri Aurobindo's, what he really has to say, what the meaning of Savitri really is. Now there's a great danger in doing this, because we might think that as a result of such a review, we understand something about Savitri. And I don't want us to make that mistake. And there are many speakers on the subject of Savitri who very happily lead you right into that box and close the door. So, I'm hoping that by reading some of the passages that convey these ideas, we will remember that it's Savitri that is the goddess of illumination. It is Savitri that is the creation. It is Savitri who has to be known. It is not these categories that I just outlined. They are virtually meaningless. But there is a structural aspect of things. And as we started out with the most elemental structural aspect, the form, the rhythm, the meter, the way poetry works, and we're moving through an attempt to explore the meaning of it, eventually we should aim to come to Savitri herself and understand something which is beyond understanding. So for the moment then, I'm going to concentrate on a few passages that deal with that for which, the aim of the sacrifice. So in this passage, right at the beginning, almost, we get an introduction to the nature of the sacrifice of Savitri. And it always entails the principle of sacrifice, the idea of sacrifice, the music, the purpose of sacrifice, always entails counterpoint. We are sacrificing for the purpose of changing something which exists in a form that is untenable. And so the method that Sri Aurobindo uses in almost every canto is to pose that which has to change with the counterpose of that which has to be realized. And by juxtaposing these two, a tension is created that we feel, and then we can perform the surrender with a full knowledge of its purpose. And that is something which I often speak about as the Vedic sacrifice. There is the call, which is a call for the gods to descend and illumine the darkness. And when that call is made with the full intention of the being, with the absolute sincerity of the being, then there is the emptiness. The flame has burned. And into that emptiness there descends the response. Sri Aurobindo explains this structure at length in The Secret of the Veda. So we generate this Agni and we formulate this opposition and we call, and then we surrender, and then there is the descent, and then there is the affirmation. And at that point, the speech of the Rishi becomes immense and luminous and joyful. So we find this pattern repeated again and again in Savitri, and so I refer to this as the underlying Vedic structure, which actually is what makes it work spiritually and not just be poetry. If you read these selections which I have, which I'm going to show you in a casual way to find out that there is an image there and a structure, it's quite meaningless like that. And so you can flip through the pages and read a few and see, oh yes, this structure is there. And this is not at all what I'm hoping to leave with you. Because this can reduce Savitri to the most meaningless, almost comical level of understanding. So we begin with what Sri Aurobindo calls the issue. There is a darkness in terrestrial things that will not suffer long, too glad a note. On her too closed the inescapable hand. The armed immortal bore the snare of time. One dealt with her who meets the burdened great. A signer of the ordeal and the path, who chooses in this holocaust of the soul death, fall, and sorrow as the spirit's goads. The dubious Godhead, with his torch of pain, lit up the chasm of the unfinished world and called her to fill with her vast self the abyss. August and pitiless in his calm outlook, heightening the eternal's dreadful strategy, he measured the difficulty with the might and dug more deep the gulf that all must cross. Assailing her divinest elements, he made her heart kin to the striving human heart. And forced her strength to its appointed road. For this she had accepted mortal breath, to wrestle with the shadow she had come, and must confront the riddle of man's birth. and life's brief struggle in dumb matter's night. Whether to bear with ignorance and death, or hew the ways of immortality. To win or lose the godlike game for man. Was her soul's issue, thrown with destiny's dice. I'm going to change the screen now. You might want to look somewhere else, inside or above. For those who have a text, I'm going to page 340. What's my page number? 306. Did that say 322?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, so this little one on the side doesn't give me an accurate count. It says 344. I'm going to switch to the vision and the boon, I think, when Aswapati, after he travels on his journey through the worlds and discovers what he has to know in order to do what he has to do, in the book of the Divine Mother, his mission is formulated very precisely. And so he confronts her, he discovers in himself the Divine Mother. You'll see, in him the Earth Mother sees draw near the change. And she speaks to him. Start on this line, and here we get another version of the nature of the sacrifice that Sri Aurobindo invokes, enacts, and communicates. What do I do about this guy?
Okay.
So this is the mother speaking to Aswapati. The computers are quite disrespectful, aren't they? Adept of the self-born, unfailing line, leave not the light to die the ages bore. help still humanity's blind and suffering life. Obey thy spirit's wide omnipotent urge. A witness to God's parley with the night, it leaned compassionate from immortal calm and housed desire, the troubled seed of things. The subject is thy spirit. Obey thy spirit's wide omnipotent urge. It leaned compassionate from immortal calm and housed desire, the troubled seed of things. Assent to thy high self. Create, endure, cease not from knowledge. Let thy toil be vast. No more can earthly limits pin thy force. Equal thy work with long unending times. Traveler upon the bare eternal heights, august, tread still the difficult and dateless path, joining the cycles with its austere curve measured for man by the initiate gods. My light shall be in thee, my strength thy force. Let not the impatient Titan drive thy heart. Let not the impatient Titan drive thy heart. Ask not the imperfect fruit. The partial prize. Only one boon. To greaten thy spirit, demand. Only one joy. To raise thy kind, desire. Above blind fate and the antagonist powers, moveless there stands a high, unchanging will. To its omnipotence leave thy work's result. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour. August and sweet, sank, hushed, that mighty voice. So Aswapati gets at the height of his realization, unlimited power to raise his kind. But only within the constraints prescribed by the divine will. He shouldn't demand a partial or a quick solution. I'm going to move now to about 100 pages forward. In this framework of sacrifice for this heroic purpose, we recognize from time to time, as we did last time, a kind of Christian imagery. This idea of sacrifice for the sake of the salvation of the world is a very Christian idea. The whole meaning of the Christ is exactly this. And so it's no wonder that Sri Aurobindo takes this image and explores it quite thoroughly. For example, in this canto, the Book of Fate, we have a very clear expression of this idea in this well-known form. Beginning with the last line, he who would save himself lives bare and calm. He who would save the race must share its pain. So there is an interesting juxtaposition here of the Buddhistic idea and the Christian idea. We will explore that much further because this occurs frequently in Savitri. This he shall know, who obeys that grandiose urge. This one. The great who came to save this suffering world and rescue out of time's shadow and the law must pass beneath the yoke of grief and pain. They are caught by the wheel that they had hoped to break. On their shoulders they must bear man's load of fate. Heaven's riches they bring, their sufferings count the price. Or they pay the gift of knowledge with their lives. The Son of God was born as the Son of Man has drunk the bitter cup, owned Godhead's debt, the debt the Eternal owes to the fallen kind his will has bound to death and struggling life that yearns in vain for rest and endless peace. Now is the debt paid, wiped off the original score. The Eternal suffers in a human form. He has signed salvation's testament with his blood. He has opened the doors of his undying peace. The deity compensates the creature's claim. The creator bears the law of pain and death. A retribution smites the incarnate God. His love has paved the mortal's road to heaven. He has given his life and light to balance here the dark account of mortal ignorance. It is finished. The dread, mysterious sacrifice offered by God's martyred body for the world. Gethsemane and Calvary are his lot. He carries the cross on which man's soul is nailed. His escort is the curses of the crowd. Insult and jeer are his rights' acknowledgement. Two thieves slain with him mock his mighty death. He has trod with bleeding brow the Savior's way. He who has found his identity with God pays with the body's death his soul's vast light. His knowledge, immortal, triumphs by his death. Just above this passage, there are a few lines. Men die that man may live and God be born. I'm going to move to one other example of this structure. 488. This is Savitri. Just prior to the passage that we read last week, and here we get a juxtaposition of that which one does to save himself and that which one does to save the world. Both are obviously necessary. At first, in her journey to find the soul, at first, out of the busy hum of mind, as if from a loud thronged market into a cave, by an inward moment's magic, she had come, a stark, hushed emptiness became herself. Her mind, unvisited by the voice of thought, stared at a void deep's dumb infinity. Her heights receded. Her depths behind her closed. All fled away from her and left her blank. But when she came back to herself of thought, once more she was a human thing on earth, a lump of matter, a house of closed sight, a mind compelled to think out ignorance. A life force pressed into a camp of works, and the material world her limiting field. Amazed, like one unknowing, she sought her way out of the tangle of man's ignorant past that took the surface person for the soul. Then a voice spoke that dwelt on secret heights. For man thou seekest, not for thyself alone. Only if God assumes the human mind and puts on mortal ignorance for his cloak, and makes himself the dwarf with triple stride, can he help man to grow into the God. As man disguised, the cosmic greatness works and finds the mystic inaccessible gate and opens the immortal's golden door. Man, human, follows in God's human steps. Accepting his darkness, thou must bring to him light. Accepting his sorrow, thou must bring to him bliss. In matter's body, find thy heaven-born soul. The way that that is done, according to this teaching, is explored in great depth through many cantos. But the movement is the same each time. So that movement is the one that Sri Aurobindo wants to convey to us if we expect these aims to be achieved. It is his movement. It is his teaching. And he has not written this poem for entertainment. So the experts have no idea what he's talking about. But we will explore carefully, and perhaps we will find out. I'm going to page 74. I'm going to read a couple of examples of passages that are very explicit. The most explicit ones that I know of. This is Canto 5 of Book 1. And in my opinion, it is a summary of the whole, the best summary of the whole, of all. I'm convinced that you could spend 10 years working on this canto, and it would be very fruitful. Anyway, this is how it goes. Admitted through a curtain of bright mind that hangs between our thoughts and absolute sight, He found the occult cave, the mystic door, near to the well of vision in the soul, and entered where the wings of glory brood, in the silent space where all is forever known. Indifferent to doubt and to belief. Avid of the naked reel's single shock, he shore the cord of mind that ties the earth heart and cast away the yoke of matter's law. The body's rules bound not the spirit's powers. When life had stopped its beats, death broke not in. He dared to live when breath and thought were still. Thus could he step into that magic place, which few can even glimpse with hurried glance, lifted for a moment from mind's labored works and the poverty of nature's earthly sight. To reinforce that idea with another passage nearby, page 78. His soul retired from all that he had done. Hushed was the futile din of human toil. Forsaken, wield the circle of the days. In distance sank the crowded tramp of life. The silence was his soul companion. Left. Impassive he lived, immune from earthly hopes, a figure in the ineffable witness's shrine. pacing the vast cathedral of his thoughts, under its arches dim with infinity and heavenward brooding of invisible wings. A call was on him from intangible heights. Indifferent to the little outpost mind, he dwelt in the wideness of the Eternal's reign. He dwelt in the wideness of the Eternal's reign. His being now exceeded thinkable space. His boundless thought was neighbor to cosmic sight. A universal light was in his eyes. A golden influx flowed through heart and brain. A force came down into his mortal limbs. A current from eternal seas of bliss. He felt the invasion and the nameless joy. Excuse me for a minute, I want to move page 80. In the hushed precincts of a vaster plan, he treads the vestibules of the unseen, or listens, following a bodiless guide to a lonely cry in boundless vacancy. He all the deep cosmic murmur falling still. He lives in the hush before the world was born. His soul left naked to the timeless one. Far from compulsion of created things, thought and its shadowy idols disappear. The molds of form and person are undone. The ineffable wideness knows him for its own. A lone forerunner of the Godward earth. among the symbols of yet unshaped things, watched by closed eyes, mute faces of the unborn. He journeys to meet the incommunicable, hearing the echo of his single steps in the eternal courts of solitude. A nameless marvel fills the motionless hours. His spirit mingles with eternity's heart and bears the silence of the infinite. A nameless marvel fills the motionless hours. Savitri has the power to create an atmosphere in which that experience can flow. If one is willing to give it the space.